Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 374, and it's side one, February the 2nd, 1979. This tape today is dedicated to a very, very dear friend who passed away. It's hard for me to do this thing. Art Cherry was a great researcher, a real patriot, organized the unions and the print shops, continued his political work up until the hour he died, wrote letters to the editors, sent letters to various researchers, purchased books, articles, magazines, spread the information, called the talk shows, wrote a letter to the editor every single month in the Palo Alto Times, showed his outrage at social changes that were for the worst and hoped for the better, and worked, as I say, up until an hour before he died, a real patriot and one of my very, very, very best friends. Art died this week. So this tape is for Art, whoever he is. I'm sorry. But I guess he subscribed to these ever since he knew about them for a long, long time. He gave me a lot of the kind of psychological support I needed to do the work I do. I'm going to miss him. So, we world watchers will have to continue without him. He'll be in spirit with us. And we need each other. Things aren't very good out there in the world. We need each other. We need people like that. So, this tape, 374, is for Art Cherry.
I promised you last week that I would review that book by Michael Lebedev called Treason for My Daily Bread, but I was so upset over the death of Art that I really didn't get time to read that book this week, and we'll get into it in the next week or so. One of the things that really ired Art Cherry was listening to KGO and a gentleman, that's a radio talk show in San Francisco, a gentleman named Jim Eason, who got on the air and ranted and raved about the Iranian students causing the fire and demonstration against the mother, the Shah of Iran, at the home there. And Jim Eason was on the air just days at a time talking about these students. Let's get them. Let's deport them. They don't appreciate this country, and they should obey the laws of our land. And he wrote a letter to Jim Eason. This is January. In January, about the 20th, complaining about the way Jim Eason carried on with these students, and he also wrote a letter to the Palo Alto Times, a letter to the editor, suggesting that these could have been agent provocateurs, that this would be a way of getting rid of people opposing a fascist regime, is to put in other provocateurs, similar to Hitler did at the Reichstag. He used the Reichstag as an excuse to round up and imprison and kill his critics, the critics of the Third Reich. And Art Cherry realized that there was so much attention at the dinner hour, similar to the SWAT teams killing the six SLA in Los Angeles. It was prime time television, and for your dinner hour, you saw these fires and demonstrations. And Art felt that before people got so worked up about it, they should consider that we still have a COINTEL program going on. And he was very angry at Jim Eason for ranting and raving about the Iranian students and how ungrateful they were. So on January 24th, 1979, this was written on the 24th, and it was received by Art Cherry on January 25th. Of course, 2 days later, Art passed away. There was a letter from Jim Eason, KGO radio station. Dear Mr. Cherry, I guarantee you this is the last time I will ever write you, and I further guarantee you I will never open any mail from you in the future. You really need help. You're either too befuddled to understand what you are hearing, or you are a deliberate liar. You have misquoted, misrepresented, and lied about me repeatedly. He said, if you cannot document your previous charges against me, your statements will go in the file along with other outrageous charges I have, right? I caution you, any further correspondence from you will go into the trash can unopened, so save your postage. Perhaps you can apply the 13 cents toward professional help to determine why you either misunderstand things or distort things you don't understand. I promise I will never write you again. Goodbye. Jim Eason, January 24th, 1979. A copy of this letter is available for competent psychiatrists to review. Well, Art was both proud and hurt, and as I say, he passed away 2 days later after he got that letter, and he wrote me a letter. I'd been talking to him on the phone every day, and he wrote me a letter January 27th, 1978, and this was written in the evening about between 12, 12:30, and he passed away at 1 o'clock. And in this letter, he refers to Jim Eason and those kind of people who don't understand what he's trying to say about counterintelligence or provocateurs. And he said, as I explained on the phone, Eason dwelt full-time on the Iranian students and lynch mobs for 9 days. Incidentally, Eason wanted to take vigilantes down there and clean up Beverly Hills. And Art said to me, he didn't rant for 5 days, which I thought it was, but it was 9 days, he has in capital letters. And when I get the strength and time, I shall follow up on that. Never, ever in my misspent life have I ever kowtowed to a bully, no matter what his superior clout. And he says, it seems as if I've always been understanding and sort of forgiving of terrorized associates and close personal friends, but not with Jim Eason, not with payrollers of genocide and extermination and humankind. No way. Now, this was written, as I say, this is last Friday night, early Saturday morning when he passed away. An hour before he passed away, he wasn't going to kowtow to people like Eason and accept the insults that he gave him and allow the ranting on the radio without being challenged. Just yesterday, February the 1st, 1978, a story was in the San Francisco Chronicle. It was also covered in Eastern papers during the week. The foreign students are hard to keep track of. This is by George Williamson. The spectacle in early January of Iranian students storming a Beverly Hills retreat occupied by the Shah's mother and sister provoked the Carter administration to threatening to deport foreign students who get out of hand. The implied weapon behind the threats was an awesome federal file that could be used to zero in on all foreigners guilty of the slightest violations of their students' visas. But the president and the attorney general are learning that they promised more than they can deliver. The U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service is not only understaffed and undercomputerized and preoccupied with millions of illegal aliens coming in through the Mexican border, but out of the 500,000 students in this country, maybe 30,000 are Iranians, and they can't keep track of them, and they don't know where they are, and they don't know who they were. So what the major media called Iranian students who were using our universities for higher learning may not have been anything more than what Art Cherry was saying it was a scene to go against students, have sympathy for the Shah, the Shah's mother, overturn cars, and put on a good COINTEL operation like we saw at the political conventions when the FBI and the military were doing their counterintelligence operations to discredit the hippies and the anti-war movements, and have sympathy for the Shah and show how beastly these unappreciative students are who have been demonstrating against him. Of course, it didn't work the way the game plan went, and the Shah had mingled among the provocateurs, I'm sure, people that really didn't want him. But all that Art Cherry was trying to say on KGO radio and in letters was, don't come to quick judgments, don't work up hysteria against good guys or bad guys, don't get vigilantes on the streets, calm yourself and find out if they really were students or if we are duplicating what happened in Germany in the 30s that brought us to that terrible war. That's all he wanted to know. He wrote letters to the station, he wrote letters to the editor, and now it turns out there is really no way to prove that those were students, and Art was absolutely right. He was right in waiting on your judgment, and he was right in not inciting riots of the right kind, right-wing kind, which was what Eason was doing for 9 days. There has been a paid commercial on Monterey television in the morning yesterday and in the evening and 2 days ago, put on by Mr. Shaw. I'm not sure if it was J. Gary Shaw, who wrote the book Cover Up with Larry Harris. Both of those men live in Claiborne, Texas. And I've called Mr. Shaw, but I haven't gotten a response, at least up to the time that I made this tape for you, to see if he's the party who put the ad on. But what the paid ad said on television was the suggestion that the government find out who killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and George Wallace, because nobody is safe in this country. The House Select Committee on Assassinations didn't do their work. There should be a panel of investigators who should demand the truth and present it to the federal government. Now, that's a wonderful suggestion, and Mr. Shaw has written, if this is the same Shaw, it probably is, but I'm not sure. There's another Mr. Shaw who's critical of the Warren Report, who lives in the Monterey area, and I'll try and locate him. But the Gary Shaw, who wrote the book Cover Up, has done an excellent job. It's a good book of evidence and facts of conspiracies. But the thing that I want to keep stressing is that there is no need to republish all this information on the ballistics evidence, the medical evidence, the proof that conspiracies took place in killing Officer Tippit, Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby, and John Kennedy, or in any of these other assassinations. The only thing that is in agreement is who was behind it all. And how did it come down? And there's no use having a panel of people get together unless they're in agreement on how it came. And while I've done extensive work for 15 years into the history of the assassination teams and how they were formed and where they met, and into the international, say the Czars, the White Russians, the Solidarists, Vaslov's army, beginning back at the end of World War I with the role Herbert Hoover played, his investments in Russia, his alignment with the British government intelligence, forming our OSS with, that was our first spy system, the OSS, the British government helping us form the CIA with Reinhard Gehlen. Unless a panel can get into that history, and they so far the researchers I know, except for individuals, just a few isolated individuals such as Lydia Blades, my friend Lydia, and Marge Gibson. Well, I can name a handful, two or three, four dozen people who are in the history behind the assassinations. But the various researchers that collect the photographic evidence or the ballistic evidence don't meet with us, and they're not interested in the history. They want to stick with the trajectory, which is important, but that's already been solved. If they don't want to go into the history of this phenomena, it will never be solved, and it'll be one more panel. So wherever Mr. Shaw is, whether he's the Shaw from Monterey who just placed the ad, or Gary Shaw, the idea is right to have the panel, but the panel has to tell the whole story. Those of you that have my tapes on the House Select Committee, or you can get them, they're listed on the sheet of available tapes. The criticism of the Assassination Information Bureau or Mark Lane, or my own feelings of what is being covered up, the John Paisley story that we've done something on in the last 2 weeks. These are what I call the bottom line or the top of the triangle, the basis of the conspiracies or the very top peak, whichever you want it to be, starting from the bottom up or the top down. But unless you go into the areas of the international, Ian Fleming, the British connections, the Canadian connections, Montreal, the Italian connections with Permandex and Clayshaw, the international trademarks. Unless you go into that, you can't solve these assassinations. And most of the researchers are not willing to take the time or energy to study the history of it. And that's the tragedy, because too many people are going to go. Art Cherry knew the history. He understood the Gehlen operation. He understood the way that people are thrown into a genocidal situation and oppressions, and more people have to study history, an overall view of who has been doing the controlling and hurting and the war shaping and keeping us in wars to keep us off guard, and doing it by killing those people who would be opposed to the wars, killing the leaders who would be reasonable leaders, and putting in puppets. that's the state we're in now, and I'll follow up the ad, maybe have more for you next week. And I don't know if it's just a local or it's a national, but we'll keep an eye on it. One of the points that was stated in that ad is that unless we follow the real story behind the assassinations, no public figure is safe from assassinating. And now we go to the very interesting death of Nelson Rockefeller, the vice president, former vice president of the United States. He tried to run for president and never quite got the nomination, was appointed vice president. He was the governor of New York for four different terms. Nobody mentions Nelson, the Attica shootout, Rockefeller, where he ordered the deaths and the killings at Attica Prison. The obituaries very nicely leave that out, just as when Earl Warren died, they had accolades for all of his public career, but if you look through the obituaries in your newspapers, you won't find mention of the Warren Report that he served on, the investigation of the death of John Kennedy. Well, Art lived one day after Nelson Rockefeller. I thought that was great. I wish he had lived a little longer to enjoy the rest of the story, but he outlived Rockefeller, and that in itself was a feat. I don't know how much satisfaction it was at that point, but that I'm always told to be careful and take care of myself, and I've given a list of precautions by everybody, including Art Cherry. But even Nelson Rockefeller, with bodyguards and chauffeurs and all kinds of people surrounding him, security systems, died. And of course, the circumstances, again, are unusual, and unusual circumstances seem to happen to political people. Whether it's the Pope, John Paul I, or Nelson Rockefeller, this globe is in a great state of turmoil. I believe it's on the brink of World War III, the Fourth Reich. The power structure is tangling itself at the very highest level, and I think that the awareness of the people, people on the streets, if you've seen the movies of the streets of Iran, the people awakened after all the savak and all the torture and the silence seething inside, the people, for better or for worse, even if they go back to the Middle Ages with Khomeini, it's their choice, or they know what they're doing, or they think they know what they're doing, but at least they're alive. If they don't like what's happening, they can get out again. But they came to life after sitting in their homes and taking oppression for these many, many years, financed by the American government. Well, the first stories, of course, the headlines this week were Rockefeller dies at his desk. He was working at his office at Rockefeller Center. He was working on a book featuring his extensive modern art collection when he slumped over his desk. I'm reading the quotes from the news stories. The truth actually was, the next story came out, that Rocky died in his private offices at 13 West 54th Street in New York City. He had a heart attack while he was working on a book. Then the story finally came out that he died at his Manhattan home, 13 West 54th Street, but it was his townhouse in New York City. The next story was that Rockefeller was pronounced dead upon arrival at 7:15 p.m. at the hospital. Later, they said that he was taken to Lenox Hill Hospital and dead upon arrival at 10:15, and then the Rockefeller secretary later changed the hour, I believe, to 11:30. Rockefeller passed away. I'm bringing this out in quite slowly for you because I want you to think of some relative or loved one that you knew, or someone who was not, say, political in nature, this political, and think of when they died and how they died, either on a skiing trip or at the doctor's office or in a hospital or somebody's home. But how many times do people change the story when a story comes out that somebody died at that place? It's usually at that place. And when they say he died at Rockefeller Center and he died at 54th Street, there's really quite a difference between a private home in an office, because if there's a possibility that somebody wanted to do away with him at this time, it would be hard to get up the elevator and into the private office where the secretaries and the guards are. It would be more difficult unless he'd been poisoned at lunch or given a dart kind of thing, similar to that umbrella poisoning in England. If somebody wanted to get rid of Rockefeller, it'd be hard in Rockefeller Center, but in a home, it's not as difficult to get the home. Well, the first reports were very clear. A normal day at the office. His health was excellent. He had no previous history or serious illness. And everybody was taken by surprise. Medical examinations were perfect, but at age 70, the heart gave out. But an immediate cremation was ordered. The services for the family were supposed to be on Monday, and large public services on Friday. And the usual procedure is to have your family service, and then the cremation and the ashes are laid to rest. But all of a sudden, the radio announced Sunday that a day ahead of time, the body had been cremated. And a Dr. Ernest Esikoff told the head coroner in New York City, the same Dr. Michael Bodden, who works with the CIA, who testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations regarding the John Kennedy medical evidence. Dr. Michael Bodden should, as the chief man in charge of the county coroner's, New York City, should order an autopsy, because the law states clearly in New York City that an autopsy is required unless physical evidence is proven that if a physician has treated that party for a physical condition that was listed as the cause of death before he died, no autopsy is needed. But if the physician has never listed or treated that person, an autopsy is required. So Dr. Ernest R. Esikoff came out and told Dr. Michael Bodden that Nelson Rockefeller had a history of heart trouble, that hardly anybody knew it, and his wife never knew it, and his sons never heard of it. But the doctor said, because he knew that he had this history of heart trouble, they cremated him without an autopsy. And that's kind of interesting, because it'd be nice to know what day he went to the office to see Dr. Esikoff, what heart tests were administered to him, where are the readings of the heart tests, what did he prescribe for them, why wasn't there any mention to your family? Usually when a man goes to the doctor for a cardiogram, he will tell his wife or family what he has if there's a heart condition. And the New York law states clearly that an autopsy is required if a person dies from some condition that was unknown up to that time of death. And the body was cremated, and then along comes Dr. Ernest Esikoff and says, oh yes, I knew he had a heart condition. Nobody else did. Now, the first news stories out were that he only had a security guard and a chauffeur with him when he collapsed, that those were the two people with him. Then, all of a sudden, the security guard and the chauffeur story faded away, and he was with a woman named Megan Marshak, who called the ambulance and asked the hospital to send somebody over right away. She said, somebody is dying, come quickly, and she gave the address on 54th Street and didn't know, they said it's an apartment, what apartment number, and she said, no, it's a house, come quickly, it involves a death, and she doesn't mention Nelson Rockefeller. I just wonder if Ms. Marshak knew who she was with. Again, the first stories were that he was working with a researcher, Megan Marshak, who worked with him for 4 years, and that she was 31 years old. Then the next story said that Megan was 21 years old, and if she was 21, then she either did a research with Rockefeller since she was 17, or she wasn't a researcher at all. She'd be in school, and there's a big discrepancy there. Then it turned out that she had worked for the Associated Press in Washington, D.C., radio, Associated Press Radio, which is a known history as a conduit for the Central Intelligence Agency, and if she was 17, I wonder when she was working, so that her age is still left open. There's various ages here and how long she knew him. And the question is, why didn't she give his name, and where were the chauffeur or bodyguard, or was she alone with him at the time that he died and nobody else was there? As I say, the cremation was quick. They had a short service for the cremation where members of the family came. And there was an article in the paper that said, in quotes, a few family members attended the service. Happy Rockefeller, his widow, didn't attend. She's secluded at the estate, in quotes, sad but dignified. She did attend the services the next day when the ashes were put in the ground. Both wives were there. Now, Rockefeller is Standard Oil, Exxon, owned Creole Oil in Venezuela. That's an affiliate of Exxon, the descendant of Standard Oil. A great deal of their oil money comes from Venezuela. And we know that Jonestown is borders right up to Venezuela. Guyana is right next to Venezuela. And George Philip Blakey from Britain, British intelligence in 1973, was one of the men who's still alive who escaped with Jim Jones' boat, who was in charge of a team who rented the property in Jonestown. One of the conditions of renting that property was that there was walking space, that they'd be close to Venezuela. They were on a river that backed up right to Venezuela. There was a Venezuela boat in the river at the time that these 910 people died, and the news media at the time said, well, they couldn't have escaped because the boat could have picked them up. But being as 110 to 210 are still missing, it could be that they escaped and the Venezuela boat took them away. These people are still missing. Also, Jim Jones had money in 14 banks, including a bank in Venezuela, and there was money involved in banking and also nursing. People went there for medical care, for drugs, for assistance, for medical problems to Venezuela. And if Jonestown was a mind control extension of the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA, Venezuela was a part of it. And the Rockefeller family was very much a part of Venezuela. These are just connections that there's nothing to prove yet. He's only been dead a week. But there also would be other motives for killing Nelson Rockefeller at this time, where Rockefellers have been behind Jimmy Carter. The Trilateral Commission and David Rockefeller handpicked Jimmy Carter for President of the United States, went down to Georgia and said, come on up, we're going to put you in office, and Carter may be the vengeance against the Republicans who lost that year. The Rockefellers were behind the Jimmy Carter nomination and the election. And we have one more year to go before the elections come up again. And one other Rockefeller, John Rockefeller, died July 1978. He was hit by a car on their family estate. We never heard anything more about that, although you think that he would be protected from this kind of head-on collision up in Westchester County. And Winthrop died in 1973. He was the governor of Arkansas for two terms. So just as many people have feared a Kennedy clan, with John Kennedy and his brothers Joe Kennedy and Robert and Ted taking over the White House and the presidency under the guidance of old Joe Kennedy, there's a lot of people that hate the Rockefellers and the Rockefeller dynasty and the Klan. And if you see how the power structure moves, they're losing a power base here with John, Winthrop, and Nelson out. That leaves David, president of Chase Manhattan, whose working agents have always been Mr. Brzezinski or Henry Kissinger. But I wonder if Kissinger and Brzezinski are serving the Prince Bernhard, Queen Juliana crowd that put Adolf Hitler into power. They are foreigners, German-born, Polish-born, and as we go into the war against the Soviet Union, which is what these people want, putting in the Polish Pope, the Brzezinski hand-picked Pope, and we'll go into that more on the other side of this tape, and now he's touting against the Soviet Union and lining up with China against the Soviet Union. They're getting ready for a war. And the loyalties of Henry Kissinger or Brzezinski to Poland and Germany may far exceed loyalties to the United States. And it even could be that the Rockefellers, if you could believe this, were too moderate for what's going to come down next. Because even though these people, corporations funded Adolf Hitler, they also helped break up Hitler and World War when World War II was over, while they rearmed the Nazis for the next war. There are levels of anger and desire to get into this next war and into fascism one more time. And while it sounds silly to call Nelson Rockefeller or Cyrus Vance liberal, there is a big split going on in the politics at the highest level, and I would say it's Cyrus Vance and Kissinger and the Nelson Rockefellers versus Brzezinski, Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Paul Assault, Bush, John Connally, and those people that are gunning for World War III. That political clout of the Republicans lining up is like an army of seven top men. And now Nelson is out, and Brzezinski would work for any one of those men that wants to run for President of the United States. There's another possible reason, motive for doing in Nelson Rockefeller. He was mentioned by Donald Donaldson, who who got 17 bullets in his head in December of 77. That was the allegations of a gentleman and Mr. Altman a long time ago, and Donaldson hasn't surfaced. And he was supposed to have the name Nelson Rockefeller as involved in the Kennedy assassination. And I feel that Nelson Rockefeller might have been done in because of what John Paisley knows now, the James Angleton connections to the assassination. I'm throwing out names without connecting all the links because there isn't time on this side. I'm just mentioning the links to the Kennedy assassination in general terms. Nelson Rockefeller also wrote a blank check for George de Marinschild, a Nazi spy, a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's, his CIA contact in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. De Marinschild died before the House Select Committee on Assassinations could call him, but he had to be directly linked to Donald Donaldson and this John Paisley that has disappeared or been killed. So Nelson Rockefeller's name came up with that regard. There would be many motives, and I could go on and cite a few more on why he would be murdered, and we'll talk about them on the other side of the tape. And, of course, the mystery woman, Megan Marshak, that is the unknown factor that we also have to go into and see what develops on that story.